Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Adam, on our show today, we have a great chance to talk with Dr. William Marston, Chief of the UNC Division of Vascular Surgery and Medical Director of UNC's Wound Healing Center, about wars against wounds.
This sounds like science fiction, Christy, but
we don't like wounds, do we?
No, well, we don't like wounds. And, you know, with the recent hurricanes in North Carolina and around the country, a lot of people suffered wounds and injuries and walking in streets and hazardous. And so there's lots of wounds that come about in a lot of circumstances. And we'll have a great chance to have good conversations about how to treat those, how to prevent them.
And prevent amputations.
And prevent amputations. Very good. Speaking about prevention, we've got some really interesting research that matters today, Christy. We're going to have a chance to look at a new recommendation about how to diagnose high blood pressure.
A little bit. Another study about diet to find out which one is best.
For lowering cholesterol.
Exactly.
Compared to maybe some other drugs. About seniors who come into the hospital, actually anyone who comes to the hospital on some medicines, do they leave the hospital still on those medicines?
And a little bit about safety for sleeping babies.
Okay,
first,
so from the crib to the bedside.
Yeah, all right. First, let's talk about blood pressure. So, I mean, obviously common. Lots of our listeners have high blood pressure. A billion people in the world, Adam, suffer from high blood pressure, leading to heart disease as the leading cause of death.
Well, and a lot of people, when they go into the doctor's office, get a little bit nervous. Now, do you get a little nervous, Christy, when you come into the doctor's office and they're putting that blood pressure monitor on
your... I do, especially
yeah, and I keep thinking
dentist.
My blood pressure is going to be high, and I know if it is high, my first thing I'm going to say is, it's because I'm anxious. And a lot of people have what's called this white coat hypertension. When they walk in the doctor's office, their blood pressure could be elevated, they're anxious, and the question is that real, and is that the best way to diagnose high blood pressure?
Well, and we have some different ways to do this. Most doctors use the values in clinic to make those diagnoses, and you have one or two elevated blood pressures, and that often leads to people getting recommendations or getting on medicine. But this was a study looking at the cost effectiveness and accuracy of using what's called ambulatory blood pressure medicine, where you wear this thing on your arm for 24
monitors,
hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And we've actually been doing this at the Family Medicine Center at the University of North Carolina for a couple years now. And it's a great way to diagnose people's blood pressure because it's like one of those old Sony Walkmans or those monitors where they can take multiple 20, 30, 40, 50 blood pressure readings over 24 hours and get a real sense of what your blood pressure is doing when you're just doing what you normally do during the day.
Well, and I love, as the physician, getting these reports because I can see the averages through the day, what it's like at night. It can help to make the diagnosis of high blood pressure in a more accurate way, and also help if we're trying to determine what doses of medicines to be on.
Right. And this is some new guidelines that actually came out from our sister country over in Great Britain, where their National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence is recommending a nicer way to diagnose high blood pressure, saying that this should be the new standard. And I think that we're going to see a rapid adoption of this as the standard way of diagnosing high blood pressure here in the United States. And I'm in favor of it. Even though I know there is some cost involved, I think it's more accurate to find out who does and who doesn't have high blood pressure.
Completely agree with you, Adam.
So our take home for this is, if you're a patient out there that has an elevated blood pressure in the office, you may want to get and ask your doctor about this ambulatory blood pressure monitor. What's next?
The next study is another one about diet to determine between different vegetarian diets, which one is best and how effective are they for lowering bad cholesterol.
Well, and they actually, so they took a group of 350 here, it's Canadians, our sisters and brothers north of the border here, who had high cholesterol. And one group got the low cholesterol lowering food. So it wasn't just vegetarian, but they had a low cholesterol diet. The other two did get this vegetarian based specific diets that were not just low in cholesterol, but they had nuts and soy proteins and margarines.
And what they found after 6 months was that the people who were on the low saturated fat diet, they dropped their bad cholesterol, that LDL cholesterol, about 8 points. But the
Is okay. I mean, you know, that's not bad. It dropped.
It's an improvement,
it's
sure.
It's an improvement, yep.
But the other groups that were using the foods like soy, milk, tofu,
the
nuts.
The margarines, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The whole shebang.
Peas and beans, and meeting with a nutritionist to help them do that, they decreased that bad cholesterol by 24 to 26 points, depending on which group they were in. A pretty impressive difference.
It's a pretty impressive difference. I mean, that's the sort of difference we would typically see with the low dose of some of the common medications called statins. And while this particular trial didn't compare those two, I don't think the people who were on the vegetarian diets had any real side effects that we sometimes see with some of those drugs. So this was, I found this incredibly exciting, Christy.
Well, and I think the take-home point is that a low cholesterol diet like this can help you avoid needing those medicines, the statin medicines, or if you're on them, it can help make a significant difference in further decreasing that bad cholesterol.
But it's not just that low cholesterol diet. It's the low cholesterol along with the nuts and soy proteins and margarine. So it's a lifestyle intervention.
It sure is.
A change, which isn't going to be easy, but you know what? It probably beats eating chicken wings on the sofa.
I would agree with that. Okay, our next study is such an important one. This is about seniors leaving the hospital without their medicines or without clarity about which of their medicines they're supposed to continue.
You know, Christy, I had a patient recently who was at a hospital, not ours at UNC, but it could have happened, I'm certain. And they came out of the hospital and they had 7 medication changes. They had 5 medicines stopped, 2 new ones started. They were so confused when they came in to see me. They brought in about 14 different bottles. It was very confusing. And luckily, they had an appointment with me real soon so that I could really sit down and go over what they should be taking.
Well, this was a study done in Ontario looking at 400,000 elderly people in the same situation. They'd gone into the hospital and they were following to see out of 5 different long-term medicines that we know are good medicines for people with certain chronic disease, medicines like the statins that we just talked about, blood thinners, other drugs like asthma inhalers, to then determine which ones of them continued to stay on those medicines after they left the hospital.
So something like aspirin, where maybe 20% of the patients had been on it before they came in, and some of them may not have supposed to have been on it when they left, but 20% were discharged without it, and a lot of those people probably should have been on it. And it's clear that as people are taking more medicines and we have chronic diseases and they go in the hospital, there's something sometimes that's getting lost when people are getting discharged.
Well, and we are charged as a nation and certainly working on this in our own institution of these transitions of care. And I think the take-home point to this one, Adam, is that if you or your loved one goes into the hospital, make sure that you go over the medicines with your nurse or doctor before you leave, but that you also
long
have that early follow-up with yep. a pharmacist, your doctor, the team, to go back over those medicines and be sure that you're taking the right ones.
Yeah, this article is in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You may have heard something about it because even some of those people who had their aspirin and blood thinners and statins discontinued, they had a slightly higher risk of going to the emergency room in the next period of time. So there are some real downsides here. Speaking of downsides, what's our very last research that matters about babies that are sleeping?
The last one's about safety.
Laying so down.
We know that babies should sleep on their back to reduce the chance of SIDS or sudden infant death syndrome. But there are lots of recommendations about not using soft things in the bed like blankies and bumpers and those sorts of things that may increase a baby's risk of suffocation.
Yeah, and this was an interesting research in the journal Pediatrics where they did qualitative interviews with just over 80 African-American mothers in Washington, D.C. and Maryland who had a new baby at home to find out, well, what were they doing and perhaps why were they doing it?
And they found out that more than half of the moms reported using soft bedding, some of the things that are not recommended.
Pillows and cushions to keep the baby comfortable.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that, Christy?
Well, just that the baby could suffocate. And so I think the reasons why they were doing it is they thought the baby might sleep better or be more comfortable or feel more loved if they had these soft things in the crib. And to me, that just says that we need to do, you know, a better job with the public health message that babies don't actually need those things to sleep better. that a firm surface on the back is the way to go.
And I think this is one of the situations where perhaps the providers for the children need to also do a job of fostering this communication with the mothers to have this conversation, to ask, what kind of bedding are you putting in on your child, and what are the recommendations?
Yep.
Well, so, Christy, this is some really interesting research we had a chance to talk about today about firm bedding.
About transitions from the hospital back home.
Ask your doctor what you should be on.
About diets that can be effective to lose and lower your bad cholesterol.
Multiple lifestyle changes. And finally, about this new ambulatory blood pressure monitor. Well, that'll conclude our research that matters. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. William Marston about wars against wounds. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Chief of the UNC Division of Vascular Surgery and the Medical Director of the University of North Carolina's Wound Healing Center, Dr. William Marston.
Dr. Marston, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
One of the things I got to know is how you got excited about wounds. I mean, wounds can be icky and gross and sometimes stinky. And how did this become your passion that you're going to take on the war against them?
That's a good question. You know, as you go into a career in surgery, my training in general and vascular surgery, it's not the first thing you think of. But we really looked for where there was a need. And we found that there were a lot of physicians that were taking care of the vascular problems, but not taking care of the wounds.
What do you mean the vascular problems? You're talking about the blood vessels.
Correct.
Sorts of things like people who get clots in their blood vessels or blockages.
Exactly. And there was a real neglect for the end problem, which was the wound itself. So it's one thing to fix the blood vessel and another thing to get the wound to heal. And it's a whole separate field there, with its own real challenges.
Well, I don't think people, at least it wouldn't be intrinsically obvious to a lot of people, my family members necessarily and our listeners, how common wounds are of all sorts. Can you just tell us a little bit about what are the types of common wounds that people get that really most of the times aren't serious, but a lot of times can be very serious?
Yes. So what really causes a wound to be serious is when the patient has a problem that prevents normal healing from happening. So this may be the patient with diabetes, maybe a patient who has bad veins, maybe a patient that has bad arteries. And this prevents the normal wound healing process from occurring. And these are common problems. We all know about the diabetes epidemic, but it's also the problem with the blood vessels not working well. And these are present in millions of patients in the United States.
What about like obesity? Does that lower one's ability, if one gets a wound, to have it heal properly?
Not obesity of itself, but the complications of that can. It's the diabetes, the leg swelling, some of those things that make wounds hard to heal.
And, I mean, I'm thinking about the number of patients that I refer to you who have diabetes and maybe don't feel their feet, something called neuropathy, where you don't feel something if you step on it or have a wound. Is that your typical patient population?
Diabetes is one of the most common reasons people won't heal a wound. And if you think about it, we have pain for a reason. It's actually a good reason to have pain. It protects us. So when you lose that pain sensation and you can't feel your foot, that's when people injure the foot and get a wound, and they continue to injure it so it won't heal.
Well, you know, I also have a lot of patients who have something called chronic venous stasis disease where their legs just swell. Talk for a minute or so about, you know, how does that develop? And is that just, it's not genetic?
Well, it may be hereditary. So a lot of people get varicose veins. We know that's so many people have varicose veins.
Their blood vessels of the lower legs get bigger.
Big and bulging. And what's happening is the blood is not returning to the heart properly. And when that causes leg swelling, a swollen leg won't heal. So you then get a small scratch or a bug bite or something on the leg. And with that swelling, the wound just won't heal until you correct the problem of the veins.
And so thinking about these wounds that won't heal, which is your specialty of how to treat them, I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that someone gets such a bad wound that they get infection in their blood and die. And the second worst thing in my mind is that they would need to have an amputation. For a lot of my patients, that's the worst thing that could happen, is to have part of their leg or foot removed. And looking at your data, it looks like over the last decade, you guys have decreased your amputations by something like 50%. How'd you do that?
Yes,
I mean, that's really significant for people.
We're very proud of that. We're also proud of the fact, and it's not just us that have been making advances, but in the state as a whole, our amputation numbers are down by about 20% in the last 6-7 years. So there's been some real advances happening. We think it's early identification of high-risk people, early referral when they have a wound, and then some advances in treatment. But you're absolutely right. About 5% of people with diabetes will get a wound in any given year, and about 1% of them will lose a toe or a part of a foot to them.
Well, let's start with an early wound in terms of with someone who perhaps is not necessarily immune compromised. They don't have diabetes, but they have a wound. They stepped on a nail. They cut themselves on a something, and they have a pretty significant scrape. Do those people? You see some of these people sometimes. What would cause them to come to you, and how do they get treated?
So here's the problem. Most of the time, if we are a normal healer, we can have bad things happen to us, and we heal just fine. The problem is, if you have some of those underlying medical problems we mentioned, then the wound isn't going to heal. And it's identifying that patient who's not going to heal quickly that needs to come to a specialized center.
How do you identify those patients early on? Because, you know, most wounds, when they're a day or two old, they don't look great in my experience. They kind of look a little, sometimes they can look like that icky, sticky, ucky wound that Christy mentioned. A lot of wounds early on don't look great.
And Adam, even I had a patient the other day who has diabetes, very well controlled borderline diabetes, who was giving herself a pedicure and cut her, like the blade went off and cut her foot. And at first I saw a diabetes patient with wound and I thought, oh my goodness. But trying to sort out with her really how well she's going to heal, what's the history of her diabetes. So how do you guide people and doctors in knowing who those high-risk people are?
So we'd say probably the most important thing is if they have a good pulse in the foot and good blood supply in the arteries. If they don't, that's a high-risk patient. And then the second is, over that first 2 weeks when you're caring for that wound, it should progress and look like it's healing. And that's a good time frame to test your plan out. And if it's not making progress after a couple of weeks, that's when it's time to get them to a specialist.
What do you recommend in terms of the early treatment of wounds that are more significant? Obviously, if it's a small cut, you know, most anything you do, Neosporin, and, you know, it'll clean up. But for a wound that is more significant, what's the first line or two of treatments?
So the key things are to get rid of any tissue that's not healthy. So if there's any infection, needs to be drained. Any tissue that looks like it's not healthy needs to come off of the wound.
Because?
Because it can promote infection. So non-healthy or non-viable tissue is a nidus for infection. And then the other thing is to get rid of that underlying cause. So if it's a diabetic patient that doesn't feel the foot, they need some type of orthotic or shoe that will get the pressure off of the wound. If they're a venous patient, has bad veins, we need to get rid of the swelling in the leg. So using a compression stocking or a bandage to get the swelling out can start the healing process.
Well, I know we're going to need to take a short break, but I guess what I really hope we'll do is continue this conversation about treatment, thinking about the next stage, and I want to hear about these advances that you guys have been making in the treatment and prevention of ulcers to reduce all these amputations. It's impressive.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. William Marston, head of UNC's Wound Healing Center, about wars against wounds. We'll be right back with your health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. William Marston, the chief of the UNC Division of Vascular Surgery, medical director of UNC's Wound Healing Center, about the war against wounds and his fight and our impressive statistics in North Carolina of decreasing amputations over time through better treatments. And Dr. Marston, one of the questions that our patients often ask and that we're all concerned about are these bacteria that can get into wounds like MRSA or MRSA that can make it hard for people to heal. What's the scoop on how much we should be worried about that in the community?
Well, it's been a very interesting scene with bacteria in wounds. Used to be up until 5 or 6 years ago, I rarely would culture a wound. They would just tend to get better when we treated them well. But over that time frame, we have had an emergence of what we call biofilm infections. And this is not really the leg doesn't get red and swollen, but the bacteria want to live with the wound and keep it from healing. And this will often be the resistant staphs and pseudomonas and sort of bad bacteria we hear about, but they're actually very treatable if we culture them and treat them with targeted antibiotics. But they're smart. They rapidly return after we finish treating them, and we have to battle against them in an ongoing fashion to get the wound to heal.
So is that how people get these superbugs? Where I have a patient recently who unfortunately passed away, but one of the things he really struggled with was getting reinfected or continuing to have infections with these bacteria that over time were resistant to lots of antibiotics and always required IV antibiotics.
Exactly, because you can start with a less significant agent, and then you may need, as time goes on, to move to more intravenous therapies. So one of the things that's emerging now is we're starting to get agents that we can use topically and strategies that we don't need to use antibiotic therapies to get rid of these biofilms. So this is where repeated debridements and some of the topical therapies we use are important.
When you say debridement, you mean just sort of cutting away the bad?
Cleaning the wound, yes. So it's not a surgical. It doesn't need to be done in an operating room. We can do it in the clinic, but it's a mechanical method to remove the biofilm from the wound.
Let's talk about some of those topical therapies, because I know everyone seems, when they come in, I hear all kinds of things that people do at home, the home remedies, the home therapies here. Talk a little bit about, you know, people want to know, you know, can I put alcohol on this? Can I put vinegar
peroxide.
On it? Can I put peroxide on it? What is the recommendations that you have for patients about what they should be doing at home? Maybe does it depend on the type of wound they have?
It does depend somewhat on the type of wound, but one thing to constantly remember is that the fluid that the wound makes is not good stuff. It's full of bad actors that cause inflammation. So you want to get that fluid off of the wound surface and off of the skin around the wound.
So that honey-colored crust
yes.
is not good on the surface.
No, and it harbors bacteria. Uh-huh. So that's probably the thing we think about most is using dressings that will absorb that and remove it from the wound surface to then allow the wound to begin to heal. Now, there are some wounds that are very dry, some of the diabetic wounds, and we will actually apply moisture to those wounds because cells won't grow if they're dried out. So it depends a little bit on the wound type as to what we recommend.
What about the solution? Does it matter? I've always learned you shouldn't put direct peroxide on the tissue because that could be harmful, or betadine could be harmful. What do you recommend? Or you just say normal saline, salt water?
So we usually use those agents, things like betadine and peroxide, if we are trying to eliminate bacteria or things like that from a wound. We're not in a healing phase, we're in a control phase. That's short term. Then we move to something that's not caustic, that's going to support the cells as they heal, and that's typically a hydrogel, a gel form of saline, those types of things. Sometimes we use topical antibiotics if we have a targeted bacteria we're trying to treat, but generally we don't.
So for patients out in the community, I mean, I wonder if our listeners are like, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to use peroxide, or I am. When people with the general wound, or if you have diabetes and are developed and have a cut or a wound, are they? Do you tell them to avoid some of those?
We do.
Just use soap and water.
Correct. A good antibacterial soap is a good start. And really, we don't like to use a lot of things like Neosporin because there's a lot of allergy to those substances.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to go with things that are very supportive of wound healing. If we think there's an infection, we want to diagnose that and treat it.
Just clean it with antibacterial soap, and then if that's not doing the trick, go see the doctor.
Yes.
Well, you know, obviously you see some of the more advanced cases. We didn't mention before, we probably should have, that I'm sure smoking is a big cause of people ultimately developing blockages that could impede their wounds and their legs. What happens right now when these initial wounds aren't healing? Where do you go with that? And short of amputation, is there anything else?
Well, I think just to speak to the smoking point, we always educate our patients that if you have a wound, you're trying to maximize the amount of blood and oxygen that gets to the wound to support healing. And when you smoke, you vasoconstrict those capillary beds and you inhibit the healing process. So that's one of the best things a patient can do, is to avoid smoking. Now, if we do have a patient that does have poor blood supply, that's one of the key things to do, is to try and improve that either through stenting or a surgical approach, or things like hyperbaric oxygen, which can improve the oxygen supply to the wound to heal.
Let's talk about hyperbaric oxygen. I know this is something that you're involved in. Explain this to our listeners. What are we talking about, going into a chamber?
The iron lung patients with polio.
Yeah.
What we see on TV, that's kind of, you know.
Describe it for us.
So really the concept here is that your lungs are so efficient at extracting oxygen that you can breathe 100% at normal pressures and only increase the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream by 3%. However, if you go to pressure, to double the normal atmospheric pressure or 2.5 times, you can increase the amount of oxygen that dissolves in the bloodstream by tenfold. So that's the key, is to be in a chamber that can be pressurized and can increase this quantity of oxygen that goes where it's needed. So the center of a wound has a low oxygen content, and this can drive that up and help it to heal.
The more oxygen the wound gets, the better it will heal.
Correct. So it's critical to only use this in those wounds that need it. It's maybe 10% of the wounds we see that need it.
It sounds kind of scary to go into a chamber of high pressure. Mm-hmm. Do patients get anxious about this, or what is the experience like?
Very few patients have problems with the therapy because it's an acrylic, completely clear chamber. They can see out. In fact, they watch TV during the treatment sessions.
High pressure, low stress.
It sounds scary.
I would say very few patients have trouble from that standpoint. It really feels about like taking a plane flight. When you go up, your ears pop and mm-hmm. you have to clear them. But once you get to the pressure that we've prescribed, you feel nothing for the treatment time.
This sounds like this is some research that's here and advancing. What's the other cutting edge research that you, your colleagues around the country are involved in? And where do you see in the next 5 years? You've had some dramatic improvements, dramatic successes. How do we keep this going, I guess, is the question, so that 20 years from now, people said, you know, I saw an amputation once.
We would certainly hope to be there in my lifetime. We think there's two main fronts for improvement. One is going to be better technology with our stenting and other similar devices to allow us to open up blood vessels. It's changed so much over the last 20 years that we think it will continue along those lines.
Even in the smaller blood vessels?
In the smaller vessels, and hopefully we'll get better with preventing reblockage of those vessels after stenting and similar procedures. And then the other line is there's a lot of hope for the use of the patient's own stem cells to help regrow blood vessels in the limbs that need it.
Okay, explain that to us.
Yeah, I like it. We're getting into some science fiction. I like this.
So we have in our body, in the bone marrow, stem or progenitor cells that are the cells that the body needs to develop new blood vessels. Whenever you have a wound, your body grows new capillaries into that tissue to help it heal. However, many patients, particularly those with lots of medical problems, those cells don't get to where we need them to be. So the idea is to take some of those cells out from the marrow and reintroduce them in the leg or the foot where they're needed to help new blood vessels develop.
That is so exciting.
We're very excited about it. And at this point, we are involved with two different strategies to do this in clinical trials. And at the end of this year, we'll be starting a phase 3 study, which means it's passed the first two phases successfully with promising data. And if this trial is successful, it will hopefully have a chance of making it to general use.
Well, I know we're going to have to wrap up, but I know you're also doing an educational program. You're going from the bedside to the laboratory and back out into the community. Just in a few seconds, tell us about this new campaign. It sounds like a public health education campaign you're starting.
Yes. Well, we're not starting it. There's a group in Florida, but we're going to be working with a North Carolina branch of Save a Leg, Save a Life. And basically, it's a campaign to get everybody involved, from patients to nurses to physicians to therapists, together in one room to try and educate and help improve outcomes for patients with these problems.
A team approach.
And we'll put, we're going to put some information up on this program and campaign on our website. And we'll also have a few more minutes of our conversation with Dr. Marston that you can come to on our blog. And if you like this conversation, a few other questions that we're going to have time to talk with there.
Thank you, Dr. Marston, for being with us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
Yes, Christy, we're going to have some really interesting things that we get to talk about today, like a head lice in preschool and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
About ear ringing and about the relationship, if any, between hurricanes and headaches.
And if you out there have some questions you'd like us to address on your health, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Let's listen to our very first house call today, Christy, about someone whose daughter is in a new preschool and someone was diagnosed with head lice.
My daughter went to a summer camp at her new preschool and they told me that they have a case of head lice. What should I do now, and what if she develops symptoms? Are there any organic treatments with no pesticides?
There are lots of questions here. In terms of what you should do, there's not a lot to do. There's no treatment recommended for your daughter who's possibly been exposed to the head lice at preschool, but it's good that they let you know about it so you can watch out.
And, you know, I mean, obviously, if everyone in the preschool, if like 5, 6, 7, 8 kids were to come down to it, and that can sometimes happen, they will recommend treating an entire classroom. So I have seen that, particularly in camp sometimes. But the biggest thing is to be aware of the symptoms, because a lot of kids who have lice don't have symptoms. And those that do, frequently there's going to be itching of the scalp. And that's due to that saliva of those lice that's real irritating when they bite.
And kids can get these little nits in the hair or in the scalp as part of the lice. And so that's something to kind of look out for. But I would basically just watch and see if she's scratching a lot, then take her in to her doctor and get checked out and potentially treated from there.
And some treatments without pesticides. Well, first off, let's see if our resources at the Health Sciences Library can maybe put up a picture of a head louse, because they're kind of ugly. But, you know, the treatment without pesticides, there aren't a whole lot of really good treatments. There is one, and the pesticides aren't great, but they may be 75% to 85% effective. But there is something called wet combing, where you can essentially with the hair being wetted with maybe olive oil or some other conditioner, you can comb the hair. But you have to do it every single day until you don't see, in each day till you see no lice there. And you have to do that every day for several weeks. And that can be effective.
So let's take our hopefully that's helpful to you, and we'll take a second to take our next house call about ADHD.
I think my son might have ADHD. How do I know, and what treatment options are available?
ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That is a really good question and a really common disorder. I wonder why one would think one's child might have ADHD, Christy. What sorts of things do you think might be going on?
Usually the symptoms have to do with increased activity or hyperactivity, with problems with decision-making, like interrupting others or not thinking things through.
Meaning like if I blurted in right now.
Yes, Adam.
Okay, we know that I'm a burned out ADHD, but you're absolutely right. A lot of times it's difficulty organizing things that other people can do easily.
And trouble paying attention, being forgetful, losing things, starting a task and not being able to finish it, that sort of thing.
Talking excessively.
And up to 10% of kids now have this diagnosis of ADHD, which I find really remarkable, Adam.
Yeah, and oftentimes the diagnosis comes from a list where you fulfill some criteria, but usually it's coming from both the home and in this case, probably the school. So getting together the teachers and the parents and getting their assessments together, the diagnosis is usually pretty obvious.
And you say, what do you do to get the diagnosis? You go to the doctor and you'll get these forms, and then you have the parents and the school and different people fill those forms out so that you can determine if the symptoms are consistent in the different places where the child hangs out, and get everyone together, as you're saying, Adam, to come up with a plan as well.
Yeah, we wish we had a blood test or just one big gold standard, but it is takes some time and a team here. And the treatment, boy, we could spend a whole show. Maybe we should be spending a whole show or more talking about this, Christy, because there's lots of things like stimulants, lots of different types of stimulants, and even sometimes the old-fashioned tricyclic antidepressants are even sometimes used.
Well, and there are a whole host of behavioral things you can do in the home with structure and star charts.
CBT.
Cognitive
behavioral therapy.
Following routines that can be very helpful for children even before needing medications. So good luck to you, and do go and talk with your son's doctor about your concerns.
Well, we're going to take another question from another listener about a condition called tinnitus, or ringing in the ears.
Does tinnitus run in the family?
So tinnitus or tinnitus, people say it all kinds of different ways.
Say
I say tinnitus.
I say tinnitus too.
Oh, you do. It's this feeling of ringing or buzzing or like there's a hissing or something in your ear. It can happen in both ears as well, and it can drive people bonkers.
Have you ever been? I don't know about you, Christy, but I used to go to concerts as a kid.
Yes.
And I would be always next to the speakers, it seemed like. And then the next two or three days, I would have just low-grade buzzing.
That explains a lot, Adam.
The buzzing or the concerts. They were the Grateful Dead concerts. Come on now, Christy. But, you know, and that stuff usually goes away. But here we're talking about, like, I've got a patient who has tinnitus because he was worked out at the airline industry as an aviation outside with the planes. And after 10 or 15 years, he has now longstanding tinnitus.
Well, and usually it comes as related to age-related hearing loss or, as you're describing, noise-induced hearing loss. Or some people can get it from taking a lot of aspirin can cause it. Or other problems like Meniere's disease, where tinnitus is one piece of having hearing loss and other problems in the ear.
Dizziness and nausea. And it turns out that Meniere's disease does have a genetic piece. We were looking at some research from the neurology literature earlier this year, where they looked at the evidence of this Meniere's disease and genetic traits, and suggested there is an inheritance and a chromosome 5 in this particular case, where it's linked up, as well as people who have congenital hearing loss. There, by definition, if it's congenital, there's probably some linkage with genetics, but there doesn't appear to be a linkage with just people who develop it due to environmental issues. You're not more predisposed. You could prevent that.
And most people who have this, it's a symptom of something else going on. So go and check it out with your doctor and take it from there. But it doesn't sound like it typically runs in the family.
Well, let's talk about our last particular house call relating to probably the recent weather we've had and someone's headaches that may have gotten worse because of the hurricane.
Does the hurricane and the pressures have anything to do with allergies and sinus and headache-related problems?
Well, it's a question that I wonder, too, because I suffer from headaches. I don't have so many sinus problems, but certainly hear a lot of people who have changes in their headaches or their sinus and allergy symptoms and feel like the weather is a trigger for that. It has never been for me personally, but I hear that from my patients.
Well, and we also know when you are people who fly all the time, when they get up into the air and they're actively problems in their sinuses, they have a lot of problems with that change in pressure. So we know that some people really are really sensitive, and if you've got a cold or a sinus problem, that you're going to have a problem. And then people have migraines. Sometimes really can say when the temperature changes and the pressure changes, the migraines are triggered. The problem is it doesn't seem to be right now enough research to be consistent to know how to interpret the literature.
Yeah, when Adam and I looked at this, there is an association between weather and headaches, but all the studies aren't really consistent, and there's basically just not enough information and research out there to say. I'm not going to argue with my patients who tell me that it is a trigger for them. Because
right, and if you do happen to have one of these migraine-associated changes, it may be helpful to preventively take a medicine before you get exposed, or mm-hmm. even sometimes people can take some Aleve or Naprosyn or ibuprofen sometimes early on, and that might be a time for it to take it. We hope that you didn't have too bad of problems during the recent hurricane, and hope that you and everyone else in this region and state and around the country are now doing better.
So, Adam, we've had a chance to talk about lice and talk about ADHD.
About tinnitus or tinnitus and the ringing and hopefully some ways of preventing it.
And a little bit about the linkage between weather and headaches and sinus problems.
Great. Well, that'll conclude the house calls, and that'll conclude our Your Health show today. Thank you for joining us.
We hope that we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to email us, call us, reach us.
You can join us on iTunes and listen and have things delivered right to your door.
You can go to yourhealth@unc.edu. Go to our online blog at yourhealthradio.org.
And we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. William Marston. We hope to join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.